Hi, Eddie here. Red and I have used Zencastr to record all of our episodes of Punk Rock Elite because it's easy, browser-based, and it gives us separate tracks that are easy for me to edit. It can also be used for 4K video too. Maybe we'll try that one day. It's really easy to use. It can do a lot of the editing for you, clipping out your ums and ahs, and adding an EQ to bring out the best in your voice, all from a single website. If you want to make a podcast but aren't sure how to go about it, then Zencastr provides everything you need to record, edit, and distribute your new show to Spotify, Apple, and a ton of other places that people get their podcasts. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our code PUNKROCKELITE, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story. Punk Rock Elite, a podcast about NoFX. What are we going to do now, Red? Kurt Cobain's dead. What's going to happen to us?
I think that we should, you know, let's stick with the three-piece.
That's a good idea.
I think the three-piece is really working.
I don't have room for four people in my life, Red. That's not to say that the three-piece can't become temporarily a four-piece for a bit later, but that's going to have to take a... it's going to be a long time to the run-up to that.
Well, I just think that, you know, the three-piece works. I think we should get a cool drummer that everyone likes. I think we should get a bassist that people have forgotten exists and a singer who, again, everyone is a big fan of.
Mm, yeah, I think one of the bass players to sort of be like quite integral to the sound, but then ultimately get very bored of doing that and just be sort of kind of lazy about it afterwards, I think.
Also, and I've just been, you know, I've been throwing around some ideas. Mm-hmm. What do you feel about band members whose names are French puns?
I mean, that's not the sort of levity I've come to expect from the early 1990s music scene. I think, you know, the funniest I want is for a funk band of rapists to wear... their penises. That's the funniest one these bands to be. But, I mean, to be honest, I'm that upset about grunge being dead that I'll try anything, to be honest. I just need I need something new.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, we've got something new for you.
I'd also like something colourful, if that's possible. It's all been a bit drab.
Well, I think what we should do is, you know, like a band who are, whilst they're named after just getting high, yeah. I think it would be really fun if, like, there was a juxtaposition where they were also one of the most industrious bands of the 20th century.
Oh, okay. So they're just wearing slacker face. that's what
weed
we're doing.
Face.
Yeah, they're playing weed face right here. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think that's it. I want them to be equally at home in a small club and on a big arena.
Stoners have never been so busy.
That's the 90s. They were out making movies. They were out making bank.
True.
We've carried this conceit on for much longer than we normally do. Yep. Hello, everyone. This is Punk Rock Elite, a podcast about NoFX, where today we're talking about Green Day.
We apologize. We don't normally hit the 3-minute mark on these little riffs.
No, we don't. No. But I suppose, you know, 3-minute powerhouses of excellence and Green Day, don't they go together?
Sure.
Why not? Today, the main body of this, we're going to be, it's another peer pressure. It is probably the most successful punk album of 1994.
Absolutely. I think you're very correct in that. I also think that we may be talking to some new listeners, given the popularity of this album. And therefore, again, apologies up top for the riffing.
Yeah,
the start of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
please know that our regular listeners are very much on board, and we welcome you new listeners in.
We do, of course.
Sit down, take a seat. We'll try and be as polite as we can.
If you like 90s punk, then you've pretty much landed in a place where you'll feel pretty comfortable, I would think.
So this is your safe space.
That's what we do. I'm Eddie French. I'm here with Red Redmond.
Hiya.
Yeah, so that's who you're listening to right now. And we are... It's 30 years since 1994, so we are spending the year, partially spending the year, talking about albums that are now 30 years old.
Absolutely. We've done Offspring, the name of that album escapes me, Smash.
Smash.
We did Smash. We've done Suffer by Bad Religion.
That was Peer Pressure, because that was released in 1988.
Oh, of course, of course. Under the Influence.
Under the Influence, where we look at NoFX's influences. No, the Suffer album we'll be doing eventually is Stranger Than Fiction. That's...
That Bad Religion album from 94.
But because we've done a Bad Religion recently, we'll probably leave it a few months before we dip back into Bad Religion again.
Yeah. So we've done Rancid, Let's Go as well. That was good.
Trashed by Lagwagon.
Of course.
So, yes. So let's see if the Green Day fans are a little more polite than the Offspring fans who took against our episode, enjoying the album that they apparently like.
Because remember, guys, this is usually a podcast about the band NoFX, who we are massive fans of. Mm. And, you know, we will be completely upfront at the top of this. We aren't as much Green Day fans as we are NoFX fans, but we certainly appreciate and respect Green Day for all they've done for the punk genre.
I heard Green Day before I heard NoFX.
Yeah, that's I probably just, did as well.
That's just the natural order of things if you get your music through the charts like we all had to in the 90s.
Absolutely. That's just science.
Yeah, exactly. So we come here to talk about specifically about Dookie, the 1994 yes. album. But we will get to that. We've got to do our bits of chatter. How have you been, Red? What have you been up to?
I've been very well, thank you. I've been a little bit ill, but all been fine because I've got a new pair of pet rabbits who, you know, when you're ill, what's better than just hanging out with the pets what you love?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very, very true. I haven't been ill, so that's a thumbs up from me. I have been to Scotland.
Yeah.
Which is nothing like being ill, because I love being in Scotland and I don't relish being ill. So I was at the Glasgow Comedy Festival. Glasgow International Comedy Festival, begging my shitty pardon. I got that one wrong. Did my show Poser. That was nice. Got a nice review on comedy.co.uk.
That's great.
It was sort of a review. It was a review of like three different things that this guy had seen. It was like a diary. It was like three reviews, but done as a diary throughout the day.
Did you get a good like pull quote from it?
There's a handful of pull quotes that are very, very nice indeed.
Oh, that's great.
Unfortunately, they weren't starred, so I'm still lacking any stars to put on any future posters, but that's okay. So that's nice. Had a very good time. Then I was in an England versus Scotland roast battle.
Yes, I heard about this. I think it went quite well for you, didn't it?
It did. It went as well as an English person in an English versus Scottish roast battle in a bar in Glasgow. I actually won my round, which was very nice. We did lose 4-2. But I thought 4-2 was a far more respectable score than we were going to get. I thought it was going to be absolute whitewash. So,
absolutely. So is this... Is this a new era for Eddie French? Are you a bad boy battle rapper now?
No. Thankfully, they didn't have to rhyme. It was just roasting. but no, the reason I did it was because I saw there were spots available for a show on the day I was doing my show. And I thought, oh, that'll be nice. I'll do a little sweet little 10 spot on a showcase show in the evening, because my show is in the afternoon. I thought, well, if it doesn't go well, I'll cheer myself up with a little cheeky 10 where I don't, you know, consequenceless, or I can celebrate stage time by having a little bit more in the evening. It was going to be a great idea. Mm-hmm. And then I got told it was a roast battle after that, and I was too cowardly to say, no, I think I'm a bit frightened of that, it will hurt my feelings. So it was good though.
Great.
Yep.
And we've got Manchester Punk Festival coming up this weekend. I believe it'll have already happened by the time this episode goes out.
This episode will go out on Easter Monday, which is a bank holiday in the UK.
As everyone nurses their heads from a Larry Punk Festival.
A Larry weekend, yes. We'll actually be doing a live show. We can't tell you about it because we've just done it. So we'll find out what the live show was.
Yeah.
It was originally going to be an interview, but the person who said, oh, I'd like to do that interview, went, oh, that's very close to the time I need to be on stage. So
yeah.
And we went, okay, well, you go off and do your thing, of course. Please don't let us keep you. So instead, we've been trawling the internet for hot takes on NoFX, all of the unpopular opinions people have about NoFX.
And we've been squirreling away our own unpopular NoFX based opinions.
Yes. And we'll see what the audience makes of it. So that's exciting, I think. And we're going to encourage the audience, the live audience at Sandbar, to join in and offer theirs as well. So that'll either be an actual episode, or if it's not very good, a bonus episode. So either way, you win. You win, guys. You win. Because we just don't know how it's going to go. We don't know how many people are going to turn up that early in the day to hear us. But some people just like hanging out in Sandbar because it is cool. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's what we'll do. But anyway, I think this is enough. If you're here for Green Day, then just wait until the end of this sting, and we will start talking about them.
We're gonna puff, puff, pass into the main body of the episode.
Legalize, is it? And Dookie, here we are. So, 1994's Dookie. We'll do the usual information. I'm getting all of this from Wikipedia, so have a go with them, not me. So, it was released on the 1st of February, 1994. We have already passed the 30th anniversary, but that's all good. It was recorded between September and October 1993 in Berkeley, California at Fantasy Studios. It is just shy of 40 minutes long, 39 minutes 35. It was on reprise perhaps, who knows. It was founded in 1960 by Frank Sinatra, so that's good. Didn't know that, did you? Because I didn't until I just hovered over it on Wikipedia and it told me. But it's Warner Brothers, essentially. It's a subsidiary of Warner. So Green Day, who had been on lookout until that point, they signed a 5-album deal with Reprise in April 1993.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. They were big fat sellouts. They were the selliest outists of all of the sellouts. The fact that they released the best album they'd made to date didn't seem to matter to some people. But
we should say as well, we don't necessarily subscribe to like these strong opinions of like, oh, these guys are sellouts and these guys aren't sellouts. We're somewhere in the middle. You know, we understand that sometimes you've got to make certain decisions to continue making music and reaching as many people as you can.
I think it's that thing of when the Clash signed to a major and they had it in their contract that they would retain complete creative control of their output.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I thought, that's not selling out, though, is it? That's taking a lot of money to do the thing you want to do.
I remember I had journey with another stand-up once, a really long car journey, and he wasn't much of a talker. He was famous for being a bit of like a difficult guy to get on with on the circuit. And so to break the ice on this long car journey home, I knew that he was like really into punk music and specifically into the Clash. And I was like, oh, so you're into the Clash. What do you think about the Clash? And he was like, oh, I think they're really, really good. Until they signed to CBS, the like sellout pieces of shit. And it was really awkward because my dad is one of the people that signed them to CBS.
Yeah. Did you bring that up?
I didn't bring that up. I didn't have the heart to tell him.
Yeah. No, that would be, yeah, Interesting. I didn't know that about you. I knew your dad had been involved in the record business.
You know, to say like he had a hand in the signing is probably an exaggeration. He was on the promotions team, specifically with The Clash when they signed. I know like him and my mum went to like a tiny gig they did in Nottingham, like,
oh, wow,
with like just the label people there. And my mum says, but she doesn't know which one of them it was, but she said she hung out all night chatting with one of them, and he seemed to be not as interested in getting pissed as the rest of them. And I can't work out if it was Paul Simonon or Joe Strummer, but I think it was one of those two.
That would make sense. I also think Joe was like 25 when The Clash started.
Right.
Which was like ancient by punk standards. And the others were all like 18 or something, 19.
Oh, so yeah, no, it could have been him then. So quite possibly.
So it may well have been Joe, but he wasn't opposed to a drink. So who knows? But that's nice to hear. So it was produced by Rob Cavallo and Green Day. Rob Cavallo is primarily known, according to Wikipedia, primarily known for his work with Green Day. I believe some other people. I believe they chose him because they were impressed by the work he did with the Muffs. Yeah, they released their self-titled debut album, The Muffs, in 93. So presumably that was where they heard that. But he has worked with Linkin Park, My Chemical Romance, Eric Clapton, Beth Hart, The Goo Goo Dolls, The Dave Matthews Band, Kid Rock, Jawbreaker, Alanis Morissette, Black Sabbath, Phil Collins, Paramore, Sixpence None the Richer, Lil Peep, I don't know who that is, One OK Rock, that's a Japanese rock band, Shinedown, and Meatloaf. So it's all right, isn't it?
Yeah, no, really eclectic mix.
Yeah, he's been busy, hasn't he? Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, good on you. A huge amount of stuff going on there. And I got to say, he did a great job on this record because this record sounds fucking brilliant.
Yeah, it does.
Production really is good. Just so, so good. Well, but we'll get to that. Yeah, so after this, they became sellouts. They, Maximum Rock and Roll, Tim Yohannan, who was involved in was sort of the founder, I think, of Maximum Rock and Roll Radio and the zine, called them sellouts, and they were banned from 924 Gilman Street, which Tim Yohannan was also involved in. So, yeah, they went from, like, I think sort of famously, this could be apocryphal, Green Day's first gig was Operation Ivy's last gig. Like, they were like the baby support band for Operation Ivy's last gig.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. Well, because Billy Joe Armstrong was offered the role of second guitarist in Rancid.
Right, yes. No, I've heard this before, yeah.
And he co-wrote Radio by Rancid. That was one that they wrote together, he and Tim Armstrong. No relation, apparently.
That would have been confusing, wouldn't it? Having the two Armstrongs.
There's loads of stuff I could go into about the direction Rancid would have taken and how interesting it would have been if they didn't have the injection of macho swagger that Lars Fredriksson brought to the equation, which I'm largely lifting from conversations from the 11th Hour, the recently finished Rancid podcast. If you want to hear sliding door theories on what Rancid could and would and should perhaps have been, listen to that podcast because they make compelling cases for that kind of stuff.
That sounds fascinating.
Yes, it really, really is. Although they do spend a lot of time talking about how much they hate pretty much every other punk band of that era. So, like, they just said straight up, we're not going to talk about the split that it would no effects because there's no value to that. And it's like, all right. So anyway, we're talking about Green Day. So yeah, so they did all of the recording and all that kind of stuff, and they made a 14 track album that's just really, really wonderful.
And I think the first thing I'd like to say about this album, given, yes, you know, like the context of our podcast, obviously this is a podcast about NoFX largely, and we're covering a lot of bands that have either influenced them or broke at a similar time to them. And You know, so we've looked at Let's Go by Rancid, Smash by Offspring, Trash by Lagwagon. And this album, I think the thing that really jumps out at me from the start is like, man, there are some songs here over 3 minutes. I mean, this is basically jazz. This album doesn't end.
No, there's a lot of like instrumental breakdown bits.
Yeah.
There's sort of little there's groove. And I mean, stuff like that. It's the most mature album of all of the ones we've looked at, in the sense that it seems to be primarily songwriting. You could make the case for Lagwagon's thing because there's lots of sort of riffier stuff and things like that. But this is a song album because there's very little in the way of there's virtually no riffs.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little in the way of like lead guitar. There's some little melodic bits, but there's no solos or anything.
It's mostly chord work, isn't it? And I suppose, you know, like, so really interesting listening to this after Bad Religion's Suffer, which we looked at recently, because I said on there, I think like Bad Religion are a great band, but I don't consider them to be particularly songwriters.
Mm.
But this album is, as you said, it's full of songs that are written to be songs, less riffs, more melodies, and generally a longer album than a lot of the albums we've been looking at.
Not it's only 40 minutes.
I imagine it's probably not quite as long as Let's Go, but it's not, but
Let's Go has over 20 songs on it.
Sure.
This has 14 songs, and to be honest, the digital edition is 38 minutes 19.
Wow.
Because it's actually got 15 songs on it because it's got the hidden track. And the last track, FOD, is just under 3 minutes long. And the All By Myself track is 1 minute 40.
Oh, so the All By Myself track originally, that's a secret track, would like FOD run to like,
yes, FOD runs to 5 minutes 46,
right?
But only just under three of that is actual music. There was like, was popular in 1994 or in just in the 90s, the secret track, the hidden track.
I think that that is a better way to listen to it, because what I did is I listened to it on Spotify, where the hidden track is just another track in the track listing.
Yeah.
And at the end of FOD, I was like, oh, really looking forward to this final track. And it's just, you know, a silly bonus track, like at the end of most 90s CDs.
Yeah, absolutely. So were you not that familiar with this particular one, Red?
Not as like a long play. I'm familiar with most of the songs on it. But no, I don't think that I've ever actually sat down and listened to Dookie start to finish.
Right. Well, because by the time, you're a shade younger than me, by the time you were getting into this, Dookie was already like bread and butter.
Yeah, like by the time I was getting into music, Green Day's biggest album was like their greatest hits had just been released.
Oh, the International Super Hits.
Yeah, which I did have and very much enjoyed. And that's probably how I got into Green Day.
That was just before American Idiot, wasn't it? Or was it after?
I think it was, you know, a good 5 years before American Idiot. I think it was quite a while before.
Well, I don't know if it was five, because it was after Warning, wasn't it? It's got songs from Warning on there.
Yeah, it is after Warning. You might be right.
So Warning, I think, came out in, let me see, I was doing my A-levels.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean it would have been 2001 at the latest. And that was 2003, wasn't it? American Idiot, something like that. That was like a George Bush.
It was a Rock George Against Bush response. Era release.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Warning came out October 2000. American Idiot came out, 2004, September 2004. So their International Super Hits was 2001.
Oh, okay, sure.
That was like 3 years before that, because I remember thinking that they might be stopping after International Super Hits. I thought they'd put out their greatest hits and were then calling it a day, because I thought Warning was drab and shit. An opinion I still hold. But
I still think the title track is pretty great. But that's
there's a couple of songs on there that I think are okay. But it was I just felt it was a bit. I don't know what I thought. It was just like nothing really. Nothing stuck. And then they came back, and you know, a lot of people thought American Idiot was like their first album. Like they felt like a very new band.
Absolutely, and I think. So, like, I'm a big fan of this era of Green Day that we're discussing today, Dookie.
90s Green Day is my favorite Green Day, definitely.
I do have a little bit of a complicated relationship with Green Day because when I was a teenager, that's when, like, Green Day were at their biggest. So, like, American Idiot. And I don't know if people remember, but American Idiot had an unusually long shelf life. Mm. So, like, 5 years after American Idiot came out, it was still one of the biggest rock albums on the planet. It was a really weird time for music because I remember it was released, you know, as you said, in like 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
But like it was still being listened to or discovered in air quotes by kids in like 2009. I don't know. It was.
Yeah. And they still had, and they were releasing albums.
Well, I remember they won like an NME award for American Idiot like 3 years after it had been released or something. I don't know if it was due to like a reissue or something, but I remember at the time being furious at my TV. I'd stayed up late to watch the NME awards and I'm like, this album wasn't even released this year. What are you on about?
Yeah, it's a strange one. I was pleased that they were making music that felt more similar to 90s Green Day.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that. But I also sort of felt like other bands were doing that stuff a bit better, and they—I don't know—it was also where, you know, they were starting to play just enormous venues. I mean, they always were because they were massive in the 90s. But
I think, like for me, like I never disliked. I think I unfairly wasn't a fan of Green Day, but it wasn't due to their music. Like I liked what Green Day were putting out. What was unfortunate was just at the time that Green Day were getting stratospherically huge, you know, around American Idiot, like a lot of, you know, like cool kids and people that I didn't like at school started to really like them. So it was sort of like, I didn't like them by association, but I think their music
problem,
is perfectly reasonable.
It's exactly the same thing that Nirvana had where...
Yeah.
Kurt Cobain was like, the jocks who used to call me the F slur and kick my head in at school were coming to my show and enjoying it. And I'm like, I don't want you to enjoy it. Fuck you. And you get that from a fan perspective as well. Mm. You know, I know a lot of, I was never that big into them, but a lot of my friends who were well into Blink-182, who like, you know, were like, got Cheshire Cat and stuff and were like, oh, this is so cool. And then Edinburgh of the States and they're like, oh my God, and all this stuff. Watch this video. They are literally running around with their junk out. It is mental. Jackass. Right. You know, all this kind of, like, they were super excited about it. They loved it. You know, they really dug on it. And I like What's My Age Again. I think it's a good song. It's not aged, but it is, it's catchy and fun and, you know, it sounds great and all the rest of it. Like a lot of that album, Edinburgh of the State, you're like, oh, this is fun. And then, like, All the Small Things became, like, massive. It was a huge hit in the UK, like a legit radio hit in, like, 99 or something like that. And all of these people who hated rock fans were like, yeah, it's all right, it's Blink-182, it's all right, actually, that. Yeah, it's all right, that. Yeah, I like it. And they were livid, absolutely livid about it. And it's that thing, you know, you... especially when you're young and you found your special thing, if someone, because it's like literally who's been in my room, you know, you get, it's that kind of invasion of privacy that you feel like that when you're younger, you forget what that feeling's like. And then when you get older, you go, I can't believe I gave a shit. But, you know, it's all right to give a shit when you're young. You're supposed to care too much. So Dookie, well, we've contextualized Dookie for you. So we start off, all right. Oh, no, I've just made a couple of notes here. So, so it's sort of dissatisfaction and mental health kind of thing. There's a lot of mental health stuff. There's a lot of boredom. There's a lot of not really seeing a future. And it's like that, which grunge also dealt with. But this deals with it faster and in a more sort of chirpy and also sort of a slightly more dismissive, like, whatever way. It's a bit like, eh, what are you going to do? You know what I mean? It's
rather than dwelling. It doesn't wallow in itself.
Wallow, that's a good word. Yes, that's it. It's not particularly mopey, even though some of the lyrics are kind of, it's like, yeah, that's what I like about it. So we start out track number one, Burnout. So all about doing all the weed. And this is, I think this is a great opener for this album.
Yeah.
Because it's like all of the bits of the album are represented in this song.
Yes.
I think. I love the drum fills at the end. Ba-na-na-na-na. You know what drums sound like.
The drums on this album are fantastic.
The mix, the production on all of this is so great. You can hear everything with such clarity without it seeming like they're separate. It still sounds like one thing, but you can pick out all of this stuff. The snare's got a real whip crack to it. It just sounds great. And everyone is playing brilliantly. Yeah. It's a little triumph, this album. If they did this and nothing else, it would be like, whoa, where were this band?
Oh, yeah.
You know, because they were sort of very influenced by all the Gilman stuff, which I think is why it stung even more to be like banned from Gilman Street, because they were hugely influenced by bands like Operation Ivy and Crimp Shrine and all of these sort of local bands, basically their peers or the generation just above them. A lot of these songs are where like everything starts at once. The vocals, the drums, the bass, the guitar, it's sort of all at once, but it's not fussy. It's not overblown. It's like you got a couple of guitar tracks, or it could just be one really good one. You can't quite tell. As I understand, the guitar, or for lots of it, it was recorded, the guitar signal was going into two different amps and recorded simultaneously, and then they just blended those two signals together to get the different guitar tones over it.
Oh, okay.
So he's sort of double tracking himself at once. I could be wrong. Please be kinder to me than the Offspring fans were for things. A lot of these things are things I heard maybe even in 1994, 1995. So I'm going on some old shit here. Really, really great fun. I really, really like it. It's sort of a really, again, it's that apathetic kind of thing. It's like, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's also really fast and energetic, which is really, really funny. It's like when a lot of those like Ramones core bands, the Queers, the Screeching Weasels, the the Teenage Bottle Rockets, all of those types who've got songs about being lazy and not doing anything, but they're like 1,000 miles an hour and all downstrokes, which I always really, really love as a combination. It's just really, really funny. Like, you know, that was it, Bruno Mars song, the lazy song. It's like, yeah, that does sound lazy. What's fun about that? Today I don't feel like doing anything. If you played that at like 180 beats per minute, like the Ramones, then that's a great idea. Anyway. Second track is Having a Blast, which is about plans to blow yourself up.
Yep, I think follows on nicely from the first track. I think the first three tracks here, I think, are in a similar vein.
Yes.
And I think it's a great way to open the album. I think what I'm really impressed by is like how balanced the album is. I think all the way through to the end, there's some good stuff.
Yeah, I like there's like loads of busy little drum fills in this one.
Yeah.
It's got the first, or what I've noted as being the first example of the Green Day guitar rhythm, which is when there's a bit without singing, the guitar rhythm goes da, 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 which I think it's also affected my guitar playing. So I started to learn to play the guitar in like 93, 94. And so now it's very difficult to not just do that whenever there's a bit without it. It just fits perfectly as a little bridge between singing and not singing. But yeah, great stuff. This is all sort of like
really sort of workman-like stuff.
Yeah.
Because it feels like it's all one sound at the moment. It feels like it's sort of one sort of noise and onslaught. And then in a little bit, you get introduced to some texture in the album, some different stuff. But until then, so we got Chump. I really like Chump. It's got one of those lovely sort of the big power chordy outro bit with all the sort of galloping drums, because it's sort of basically, it's sort of part of, sort of the last third of Chump is given over to being the sort of beginning of Longview.
Yes.
And it's little bits like this that make you think, oh, that rock opera bit on American Idiot makes a bit more sense now.
The bits are all here.
Then they were never shy of this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can and they've been doing it for ages. Like on Insomniac, you've got Brain Stew going into Jaded.
Mm-hmm.
On Nimrod, you've got Jinx and Hashinka, mm-hmm. which are sort of two songs that don't really, that are sort of blend in that way. So when people are like thinking, oh, they're doing that, they always did do this. They just did little bits of it. They just did it to the best of their ability at the time. And yeah, so that's the problem with me with Chump, is that I really like it, but it sort of, it gives way to Longview, which is where we're sort of getting into one of the singles. This was the first single off of this that was released at the same time as the album in February.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that was the first single they released off of this.
Yeah, well, they didn't release any more singles for about 6 months or something until the album got big.
Wow.
Like three of the singles, I think it was Basket Case, Welcome to Paradise, and When I Come Around. So four singles released off this, because it was major. They were just like milking it. They're like, yeah, go on, just churn out more. So, but the fact they released this as the lead single is quite mad, because it starts off with that lovely little walking bass line. The story goes, Mike Dirnt played it whilst lying on the ground on acid and like tried really hard to remember it the next day.
That's funny.
We should actually do the personnel. I forgot to do that at the top. So Billy Joe Armstrong, lead vocals and guitars, Mike Dirnt, bass and backing vocals, Trey Cool, drums, and guitar and lead vocals on All By Myself. Produced by Rob Cavallo and Green Day, and Jerry Finn mixed it. Neil King, engineer, Casey McCracken, engineer, Richie Butcher, cover artist, Ken Schills, S-C-H-L-E-S, that's a good name, I don't know how to pronounce that, photography, and Pat Hines, the booklet artwork. Oh, we should mention the artwork as well, because it's a great album cover.
Yeah, it is.
It's a big, I think apparently there was a poster version of it that's even bigger with even more details, and it sort of spreads out. It goes all the way down to like hell and stuff.
Oh, wow.
Which I've seen a couple of times, but yeah, it's great. It's a town being bombed. There's a Goodyear blimp. The explosion's got Green Day written in it. There's a monkey looking to throw some plop. And it just says Dookie, which I do believe means shit.
Also, what I found quite interesting was during our episode with Frank Turner, which is available for download, he referred to this album as Dookie.
And yes.
He's the only person I've ever heard refer to Dookie as Dookie. And I thought that was quite funny.
Yes. I don't know what he knows that we don't, because he might do. He knows.
He might, yeah.
He knows a lot of stuff. So we'll carry on in our ignorance with Frank laughing at us all. That, or I like to think that Frank said, all right, yeah, oh, thank you for the interview, bye, pressed leave room, and then like did like a Usual Suspects where he just sort of just started walking upright and going, ha, 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 it is pronounced Dookie. Now they're confused. Who knows? Maybe Frank is the prankster. A Frankster. Yeah, Longview. Really, really great. That sort of the Tom groove on it.
When Longview started,
Yes.
Because from my, obviously I've heard the song loads of times before. In my memory, it started with the bass line. I didn't realize it started with the drums. So when the track came on and I started to hear the drums, it actually, to me, sounded exactly like the start of Hang 'em High by Dropkick Murphys. It's got sort of like tom rhythm.
Yeah. Yes. I like the Offspring secret track on Smash. Mm-hmm. Like that sort of genocide style one.
Yeah.
That's like variants on that. On that one, it's got a similar tom heavy sort of rhythm, like a sort of a war drums kind of thing. But yeah, it starts off with, I mean, I don't know what happened to Mike Dirnt because he stopped writing bass lines a while ago. He just plays the root note.
Well, it's one of my criticisms of Green Day is like, I play bass and I am not that impressed by the bass work on Green Day. Every now and then a song like Longview comes along and you're like, oh yeah, no, I'm going to shut up. This is actually pretty great. But I think a lot of the time he is just following the guitar. I think that's very evident on the first two tracks where I don't really hear the bass in the first two tracks. I don't really hear the bass until it comes in and chump in its own sort of like.
There are some bass lines on this, but I suppose that's also being a three piece. You don't have as much. You've got to be a bit more connected to the rhythm than if there were two guitars, for example. You've got a bit more of a. I mean, obviously, let's not ignore people like Matt Freeman and stuff like that, but they are rarer than they aren't. So, you know, I was a bass player in a three-piece band for years, and you have to sacrifice, especially live, you have to sacrifice a certain amount of flair or what have you to keep yourself rooted in the rhythm, to keep it tight.
So I absolutely agree. But like there are parts in this album where I can hear two guitars and no bass, and I think that's where I think it goes a bit too far one way.
Maybe. But then, and I think it's made worse. I don't think you'd even think about that a lot if it weren't for things like Longview, where you're like, this is great. So you can do this. And even on the bits where, like when the guitar's playing at the end, do-do-do-do, it's like really delicate. It's like letting the bass be the main thing. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a really... And then when it comes in and the guitar starts off and it's all the bite my lip, close my eyes stuff, it really kicks in and it is just so solid. It's just, it sort of really clicks in and then it becomes a bit more laid back and, dare I say, jazzy? Groovy, certainly. A bit more Willow in the Wind. It's really, really great. I don't know that I'd have chosen this as the lead single because I'd see this as a slightly weirder one.
Yeah, I would have thought this is your second or third single.
Yeah, because it is, I mean, I suppose you definitely know which song it is. You're not mistaking it for another one.
Yep.
So that's something. Whether it was still in that grunge thing where having like no guitars in the verse, the loud, quiet, loud thing, maybe that was... That was a thought. Mm-hmm. Like the same way, you know, Self-Esteem by Offspring released around the same time. That is super grunge. Because it's a bit slower. It's got the no guitars and then big guitars, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, or like Creep from like Radiohead. That was 93, right? And that's, you know, similar vein.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, but people were still doing the quiet, loud, quiet Pixies thing.
Yes.
That was the hangover from grunge. Because grunge is, you know, people are still going, no, grunge is all right. It'll be okay. It'll survive Kurt Cobain's passing. Like, of course it will, dear. Get on to Welcome to Paradise.
I think this is my favourite Green Day song.
It's a great choice, and I can absolutely see why it would be. It's a classic. It was also on Kaplunk, their previous album.
Oh.
But they re-recorded it for this one. Now, I had a listen to the Kaplunk version earlier today. It's incredibly endearing. There's not a lot of difference with the arrangement, but they have used a metronome to record it on Dookie. Whereas there's some beautifully wobbly timing. They like stay together, but the timing speeds up and down all over Kaplunk.
Oh,
but
wow.
In a very, very nice way. Like, not deliberately. That would like not. Yeah, they haven't chosen to make it that way. It just has happened that way. But there's a slight difference in the harmonies on Some Call It Slum, Some Call It Nice.
Yeah.
And I don't know which I prefer because they're both very good harmonies, but they are notably different. But that's worth a listen if you're interested, if you're digging on this one. But yeah, it's also got a sort of a mad outro thing. It's got a sort of, or not a mad outro, it's got like a breakdown in the middle of it. And the crescendo and all that kind of thing. And it's like, that doesn't need to be there. But it is, and it's great. And there's a certain level of like showmanship and sort of jamming that's clearly gone on with these songs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it doesn't feel like something you'd sit down and write. It feels like something that has been co-created.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like, because you wouldn't just sort of go, oh, do you know what this bit needs? This bit needs a really weird breakdown with just sort of guitar feedback and the bass being really, really busy. And then the guitar doubling it and all of this kind of stuff. And then it comes back for a third verse and chorus, which is verging on rude. You know what I mean? It's like, because you'd expect a chorus to come back on and finish. But now we're doing the third verse. Okay, lads, whatever you like. But it is great. There's no two ways about it. Just about moving out on your own and having to live in a frightening neighborhood. It reminds me of that scene in Big with Tom Hanks when he gets his apartment and he's crying on the bed because he's frightened of all of the scary people outside because he is just a little child, but Tom Hanks. Hello everyone, Eddie here. Red and I hope you're enjoying our show. If you have been and would like to help us make it a little more easily, then you can donate to us at our Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/punkrockelite, or you can look in the show notes for our link tree. If you can't help us financially, we totally understand, but would love it if you spread the word to other people who would like this podcast. We thank you for your continued support. We massively appreciate it. Back to the show. We hop, skip, and jump over to Pulling Teeth.
Yeah, I think this is like the only track that I'm not that bothered about on the album.
Really? Interesting.
I think it's badly placed, or I know we feel very clever when we use the word sequencing on this show. But which is the track listing.
Yeah, which is the order you put the tracks in, because for the first 6 months we were going, you know, the order you put the tracks in, whatever that is called. So we feel like we've really grown as people.
There's something about pulling teeth in between, you know, two of the strongest tracks on the album. And then there's something else about it being called Pulling Teeth, because that, you know, it does, when, you know, waiting for Basket Case does feel like pulling teeth.
Well, it's actually about domestic violence, Red, so...
Well, aren't I a shit?
Do you know what? Sure. Do you know what, actually? It's this one sounds really like early Beatles to me.
I think there's a lot of Beatles comparisons to be made with this. Like,
yep.
Billy Joe is a songwriter in that vein. I think that he's clearly listened to the Lennon and McCartney songbook.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of artists have, you know, like even Fat Mike from NoFX has said how important knowing those songs has influenced his songwriting.
Yeah, well, he said if you want to become a good songwriter or a better songwriter, learn about half of the Beatles songs and you'll learn just what you can do with music, how it can be done and stuff. And I think there's a very valid point to be made in that, because that's easier than saying go and learn theory. It's like you will learn the theory, you just won't know what it's called. You know, you can pick that up later. It's like knowing what sequencing is without knowing the word for it, basically. It's like that, but for songwriting. But it's got like Everly Brothers harmonies, like all the way through, like permanent harmonies and stuff, which is great. And I really like this one. I understand what you mean in that they've deliberately put like maybe the slowest song on the album between two of the, well, they didn't know they were going to be bangers. Maybe they did, but two of the all-time great Green Day songs, whatever song you put in between those two is going to suffer in it.
Yeah.
Maybe on its own it's different, but I like it for all of those kind of reasons. But it isn't Basket Case, is it?
No.
But Basket Case is.
Yeah, it is.
And it's like, it's a 90s punk classic. I really don't know what there is to be said about it. If this suddenly came on in a rock club, whether it was 1994 or 2024, people are going to get excited about it. They are getting ready for it. They are getting ready for the bit where they all do, because it takes so long to start. And it's about like anxiety and being diagnosed with like panic disorder. And so having that really long, taut, tense intro before the drums kick in, it makes a lot of sense. It's like a really, really cleverly arranged song, because sometimes you'll see people, like, there's 1,001 covers of Basket Case on YouTube. It's just one of those, and there are people who are like, hey, let's do something a bit different with it, by which they mean do it on an acoustic guitar. But but the thing is that there's not enough difference between muting an acoustic guitar and strumming an acoustic guitar for that to really have the impact.
Yeah.
Or they'll do it on like piano. There's just something about how stark it is, just the voice and the guitar, and just the tiny little suggestion of drums coming in, and then it happens in that sort of explosive way that it does. If you're listening to this, you like Green Day, you know how good Basket Case is. You just know.
I mean, even if you don't know them, you know how good like Basket Case is.
Yeah, it's like it's basically one of those undeniable smashes. It may well be my favorite Green Day song. If that makes me basic, then fine. But it's just such a great piece of work. Yeah. And nothing really more to be said about it. It's just one of those. The video is really, really cool. They like colorized a black and white video of them in a mental hospital and stuff. And I think for a generation or two of people, just hearing Do with the first little muted strum, it's visceral. It does something. It's like it's entered your DNA and has permanently changed you. It's one of those kind of things. And people can say what they want about Green Day these days. You know, they initially didn't want to donate anything to the Punk Rock Museum because they didn't consider themselves a punk rock band or whatever. And people got the arsehole about it. And, you know, people change in 30 years, 40 years, however long, you know, they've been going for 35 now, easy. But equally, it's like, who are you trying to kid, mate? Right, this was a bona fide radio hit in the UK and the US, more so in the US. But, you know, it got a lot of play. They were on Top of the Pops. They're on Top of the Pops playing this, you know what I mean? Live from California somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, they satellited in. It was that bigger hit. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's really, really good. Equally so. You got any more notes on Basket Case?
No, I mean, you know, like, it's just good, isn't it? Like, I don't think that I can add anything to the conversation that hasn't already been said about Basket Case. We all like it. It's very good.
I mean, I didn't add anything either. I just said it again, but, you know, need to do something to fill up this time. And also, if we just skipped over Basket Case, it's not on, is it? You can't not mention it. You've got to bring it up. However, we go on to a song which I like maybe as much as Basket Case.
Yeah, it's good.
She is wonderful. And there's a very cool mention made on the Wikipedia, which just sort of contrasts how it's the reverse of Basket Case, because Basket Case starts off with just the guitar, and this one just starts off with the bass and the drums.
Yeah.
And then the others join in at important times. So I'm like, I don't know what that's saying, but it exists, and now you think it as well. So
I definitely think that the bass playing in particular improves throughout the album. Mm. And at this point, there have been plenty of songs where I think the bass is doing something interesting alongside the guitar. You know, even in Welcome to Paradise, obviously Basket Case, Longview, parts of Chump, like you are hearing more bass. You obviously hear a lot more bass in She.
Yeah.
And that's all good. I'm glad that's where it's at, because I do think Mike Dirnt is a great bass player when I can hear him play.
My favorite bit of bass on this album is yet to come.
Yeah, same.
It may well be the same, but we'll get to it. Yeah, we can't skip over She. It's about an ex, apparently, an ex-girlfriend of Billy Joe's. Apparently, there's a couple of songs about this particular ex on this album. It's great. And the Mad Caddies do a very good version of it as well on their Punk Rock Steady covers album.
Oh, cool.
It's probably the best slice of pop on the album, to my mind. You could play this in multiple different ways, and I think, you know, you could have all sorts of stuff, and it would just work really, really well. His voice is particularly good on this one as well. Just, yeah, really, really wonderful. So Sassafras Roots.
This song starts with Fuck the Kids by NoFX. The first 5 seconds or 10 seconds or however long the song Fuck the Kids by NoFX is, it's how it starts. Da-na-na, da-na-na, da-na-na.
That's a very good point. Yeah, it does.
Yes. It's a great cover as well.
Yeah. This has got like a real sort of power pop kind of vibe to it. Like
this
you
is
could
probably...
imagine Cheap Trick playing this song.
Yeah. I think this has got some great guitar work in. I think this might be the most riffiest song of the album.
Yeah, it's like the Blitzkrieg bop chord sequence, but with like bits in between it, like bridging those things. And it's got that sort of wasting your time refrain. Wikipedia, whoever wrote the Wikipedia article, has been on fire with their analysis, saying that it's this song is the most like the previous album, Kaplunk.
Sure.
But yeah, I think all I can think of is power pop, really, and that Cheap Trick thing of just sort of super catchy, and then it doesn't quite go the way you expect, but it still makes total sense. I don't know. I like it a lot. It's that whole thing of saying a thing, wasting your time. And it's sort of to do with sort of being in a relationship that's a waste of time, but it's literally better than not being in a relationship. So, you know, maybe that is the case, maybe it isn't. But the harmonies are really, really good on this as well.
And I think it's at this point, like, I really realize how it's not a heavy album.
No.
This. I mean, the heaviest moments are probably like the chorus of Longview and stuff like that, or maybe like FOD towards the end.
FOD, I think, is the heaviest one.
Yeah. But like, it's not a particularly heavy album. And I think what that does is, I think it really explains like why this was so accessible, why this was so widely played. I mean, like, this was played in every teenager in the Western world's bedroom. And I think it's because it doesn't ever become too heavy or particularly heavy. Like, it's just kind of,
but it could still upset a parent.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So it struck this perfect balance of, because, you know, you could probably, you know, the Beatles used to be considered heavy enough to upset parents.
Yes.
But this is 30 years removed from the Beatles' first albums.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're 30 years removed from this album.
Eddie, please apologize to our listeners for stating that fact. That's made us all very sad.
Yes, I mean, look, for those listening for the first time, I started this because NoFX, who are 40, were splitting up in the year that I turned 40. So, you know, we're all here terrified about our human decay. So, you know, but basically, yeah. So, which also makes me think, if we are 60 years since the Beatles coming out and being scandalous AF, then, you know, were Green Day as scandalous as the Beatles at the time? No.
No.
Were they trying to be? Not really. No, they don't appear to be. They're just doing their thing, which I always admire. But equally, there's a song, it's literally called Fuck Off and Die. and it's not written on the back because it was released by Warner. If this was released on Lookout, maybe they would have just called the final song Fuck Off and Die. They're talking about going to a male prostitute on this album. Coming Clean is about Billy Joe Armstrong acknowledging his bisexuality and stuff like that. We'll get to that. So there are things that are scandalous for the more conservatively minded parents of 1994. But equally, you know, my parents never found Green Day to be the objectionable music that was played in my house when I was a teenager. Yeah. You know, there was stuff that, you know, they were like, oh, well, I would much rather hear that than, you know, than say NoFX, for example. But, you know, it's great stuff. Speaking of great stuff, we get to another bona fide all-time Green Day classic.
This is my favorite bass work on the album.
Same. Absolutely.
Nice.
It elevates it entirely from a really, really basic chord pattern.
Yes.
To something that is just an earworm forever. It does not leave you.
Yeah.
It's like herpes. Once you've got it, you're keeping it. It's great. So, yeah, When I Come Around, that guitar intro is just so crunchy. And then it comes in with the other guitar and the bass line. Do-do-do-do-do-do. It's just... It carries so much, that bass line.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not as intricate as like Longview or any of those things, but it's exactly what the song needs to bring it to life.
And I'm really impressed with Billy Joe's voice on the entirety of this album. Like, I think it really... Yeah. Like, it's particularly strong on this song, but like, he's got such control of what his voice is doing. He's not just throwing out any random notes. He has a real control of his voice, and I feel like there's a lot going on, and I think most of it is purposeful. Like, he has real skill.
The same way I think that you can tell that certainly Mike and Trey. Mm-hmm. Everything they're doing is on purpose. They're playing to the top of their abilities, but they're not overstretching themselves. Everything they set out, everything they attempt, they manage with what appears to be a controlled ease.
Yeah.
Without being like cocky with it. And Billy Joe's voice is exactly the same, and his guitar work for that matter. But his guitar work is like probably the least complex on this album, maybe the next two albums as well, Insomniac and Nimrod.
It's so impressive for me to, obviously, you know, all of the sorts of albums that we review on this podcast, I feel a very different to this. I'm kind of like impressed how mid-tempo the majority of this album is, but like, it's still got as many catches, if not more catches and more hooks, than a lot of other stuff that we've listened to.
Yeah, I think this is, like, I suppose if we're going to go for like classic punk or older punk sort of comparisons, this is like a differently produced, like Elvis Costello kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is a lot more, again, this is songwritery rather than punk bandy. And I suppose there was always that little bit of distance that they put between themselves and the scene in that sense, but I think they absolutely earn their place in the punk conversation, because when people talk about the year that punk broke, without Green Day doing this, I don't think Offspring are selling their records the same either. I don't think, not the same, not in the same way. That whole thing is not being elevated to that kind of thing. And it's just great. There's a music video for this. And I would be a fool if I didn't mention that in that video, Mike Dirnt is wearing a China Drum t-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favourite bands from my youth, from the northeast of England. They're releasing a new album very soon, actually. They've sort of just reformed, but they released two incredible punk albums called Goose Fair and Self-Made Maniac. And then they released a weird album called Diskin, and that was under the name The Drum. But China Drum, listen to them. They're wonderful. I think they played with Green Day on one of their early tours. Oh, speaking of which, you shared an image with me.
Oh, I did.
Maybe last week, or a few days ago. Anyway, yes, we'll put it up. If you send, you have sent it to me. I'll put it up on the Insta.
Yeah. Basically, so I work at a venue in Sheffield called the Lead Mill. It's quite a popular venue. We've had a lot of huge artists from. Well, it's been open since the 80s, so you can imagine the sort of artists that have come through it. And one of the artists that have come through Leadmill is Green Day. Specifically on the tour of this album, they played Leadmill in 94, maybe 95, on the Dookie tour. And we've got an image of Billy Joe Armstrong, who I believe had broken his leg for a portion of this tour. And so is sat down on a chair with his guitar on his lap, and he's playing Basket Case. The image was shot whilst he was halfway through Basket Case.
Oh, cool.
And I don't know, it's kind of cool, a little bit of history. Nice to be connected to this album in some way. And I know that we still have the Green Day poster up in the one of our bars, one of the bar areas in Leadmill. We've still got the original poster up. Behind a cage so that people can't get to it.
Wow. And that was 400 people.
Yeah. So 400 people. According to Kerrang, there were only 400 people there. I mean, it's a 900 capacity standing venue. Mm-hmm. So just goes to show they weren't out the gate the stadium filling band that they are today.
No, it took some time. But to be honest, I bet if they came back a year later, they weren't looking at Leadmill.
Yeah,
their
right.
Menu, you know, that was, you'll have to wait till they're on the way back down again to catch them again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that might not be an option. If they're on the way back down, they can literally just stop and they will be fine.
We got Jimmy World on the way back down, but to be fair, that was a special gig. I don't think they were necessarily on the way back down. They were we'll come and do a special cool one-off gig at this smaller venue because we're cool.
So you were listening. Whoa.
What was really depressing. Right. So I quite like Jimmy Eat World. I'm not a fan of all of their output. I like a few singles, if I'm honest. But what was depressing is going and seeing Jimmy Eat World in your 30s. And even for like the big, heavy, anthemic songs that they've got, the entire audience is completely still because they're in the 40s now and they've put on a little bit of weight and they're not quite the movers and shakers they once were.
Yes. Well, I remember my copy of their big breakout album was still called Bleed American because I bought it before 9/11 because they changed it. I don't know if they changed it all over the world, but they did change it afterwards to Salt, Sweat, Sugar, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
I think I've got a copy of the Strokes' first album, which still has New York City Cops on it and stuff like that, which they took off as well, which must have made it like a 9-track album. It's a very short album. When I come around, it's like a perfect moshing speed song. Like you could, like you can literally pogo to it for the whole thing, assuming you're not over 40 and fat, like most of us now. But you know, the melody's lovely. There's a lot of stops on this album for like singing, and then the instruments stop and come back in again, and it works brilliantly. And none better than "Cause You Know Where I'll Be Found." You've just got the two voices singing "Found." Yeah. And then it goes back, "When I come," and then it comes back in again. It's one of those songs where you feel like, has this not been, why did no one write this one earlier? This one seems like it should have already been done. You know, you just hear a song that's that sort of timeless and sort of, you know, it could be, yeah, it's yeah, it's just a great bit of work. But yeah, really, really love that one. We're sort of getting into the last little push of it. So we got Coming Clean about Billy Joe's coming out as a half bent. Well, by the way, new listeners, Red and I are both non-binary, so we can use all the slurs we want. No, that's not true. But yeah, so this is about him being bisexual. It's not really a high point for me, this one, I've got to say, but it might just be coming off the back of a high point. But
yeah, I quite like it. I like, you know, I mentioned earlier, I think the album's well balanced. I don't think that these are the best songs on the album, but I think they do a good job of, like, these last final four songs, you know, being pretty good. Like, coming off the back of When I Come Around, it's difficult to hit those heights again.
Yeah, no, I don't dislike any of these. I don't dislike any song on the album. You know what I mean? This is a non-skipper for me, which is not always the case with a lot of albums, but this is a non-skipper, I think. And they work together as a piece, I think, as well. Like, more and more I'm talking about listening to an album as an album designed to be listened to as a single piece of music.
Yeah.
Which still was the trend in 1994. It's got a nice bit of that Green Day rhythm as well. It's only 1.5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
It's really, really short. And it starts off with just that sort of hanging chord. And then, again, there's a lot of space in that as well. This album's either like Wall of Sound, where all the instruments are going at once and the vocals are like kind of relentless, or like super spacious.
Sure.
And it manages to blend those two things really, really nicely, which I think is a triumph of arrangement and production. I think these songs are all incredibly well served by all the parts that they've played. You feel like this is a band that plays together a lot and tries things differently. And that kind of thing. And that's, I always have a lot of time for that.
I think also, like, in Coming Clean, I can kind of hear the beginnings of emo, which will, you know, kind of like, you know, the sort of like when, like, pop punk after, like quite a while after this, actually, about 10 years after this, but it slowly, like, morphed into, I suppose, sort of like emo music.
Yes,
I feel like Green Day were definitely a part of that change.
Emo sort of changed its meaning. From what I can remember, it was like synonymous with post-hardcore.
Yes.
Bands like Rival Schools, United by Fate would be referred to as emo.
Yes.
And it was basically, it was like, well, there's still some heavy bits, but there's also like melody and they, it wasn't really, and it also wasn't a derogatory term.
No, not at all.
And then it became, people started going, oh, that must be emo, because people thought, you know, the word gay was still being used as like a derogatory term for anything that someone didn't like at the time.
I think a lot of emo, like when it starts, it's kind of like, oh, this punk rock music is very introspective and in talking about feelings. And I think that this album is one of the pioneers of that, right? Like, it's a pop punk album, but it's about feelings and introspection.
Yes. It doesn't have the sort of arrangement that we come to think of with emo, where it's like, what are they called?
There was that Your Fall Out Boys.
Well, yeah, but then there was sort of like a pre them. There was like
Out the Drive-In.
No, because they were like credible.
Yeah,
they were like, because like emo's never been considered credible until a bit of retrospective from people who were just like, I actually did like it loads, thanks. You know, but like maybe like My Chem.
Yeah, sure.
My Chemical Romance. Who you listen to their sort of pre-Black Parade stuff, you know, there's sort of lots of like chugging rhythms, the drums are fast, they've got octave chords over the top of it.
Oh yeah,
they could sound like Alkaline Trio a bit, but the singer's a lot more, you know, I'm Not Okay, for example, is like primo.
Yes, premium
emo So unfortunately, primo also exists as a word. Otherwise, that'd be great. But, you know, that I'm not okay is what I think of when I think of that emo that people hated, that people like made fun of.
Mm-hmm.
That's when that became a thing. Because, you know, it was like, it sounded punk, but, you know, they had long hair, you know, a bit of war paint on, a bit of eyeliner and stuff. And it was, you know, a lot of like, oh, but I'm in love with you, kind of thing. And that's what people got very upset about. But there is all of those things. Like, you don't get, what is it,
Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge?
Sweet Revenge. That doesn't happen without this album.
Yes, agree.
And all of these things. So, yeah, we are looking at like the bedrock of this, aren't we? I mean, technically, the hardcore of this. So if we're talking landscaping here. But without this, without that, the topsoil, the fertile Jimmy Eat World topsoil does not give way to the My Chem.
I'm pretty sure that doesn't... In the song Bleed American, isn't there a line about topsoil? Littering the topsoil?
Oh, very possibly, yeah. So sugar on the asphalt.
Yeah.
It could say littering. Yeah, you're
It is. It's littering the topsoil.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. and then they just give you some advice on turf. T-U-R-F. Let's not get into that. Yeah, all of that stuff. I think that's super important. And so, yeah, so Green Day are... one of the fundamental building blocks, whether people out there like it or not, and some of them don't, Green Day are a keystone in the story of punk rock.
Yeah.
Whether they want to say they're punk these days, whether other people want to say they're punk, whether people go, this can't be a punk album, it's on a major label. None of that really matters, because when you are 12 and you hear an album and it grabs you and you know it's never going to let you go, that it is there, that it has become a part of you, that you're going to wear it like a skin, you don't give a fuck what fucking label put it out. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
it doesn't, it, everyone gets in their way so much. You get in your own way. So, you know, if they put out some awful early 90s pop album, then obviously people would be well within their rights to go, oh, they just wanted a paycheck and that's it. They didn't. They've carried on doing what they want to do, and that's great. We come to the song Eminis Sleepus.
Yeah.
Stupidest name on the album. Imagine an album where there's a song called Sassafras Roots and there's a stupider song name on it. Incredible. This one was written by Mike Dirnt. This is a bass player. He must have been so relieved he contributed a song to the album that sold billions and billions of copies. And was like, oh, thank God I got that one in there. That is a house. Nice one. So, I like it.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, this is a little riffy. But then it was written by a bass player, so it was probably... that's probably a bass line that's been converted into a riff. I don't know. I don't know if he might have written it on guitar. Who knows?
Yeah, he could have written it on guitar. I think what is clever is these final songs being a bit shorter. And obviously the final track's a bit longer. But like these three following When I Come Around being under 2 minutes, I think is a good idea.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's a nice bridge. The nice bridges with the ringing bass thing, and I think the hook is super catchy. When you go, I think you're sick and I want to go home. It's like there's something really funny about saying I want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
I've always found that really, really funny as just in any situation. Like, people go, how you doing? I want to go home. It's like I cannot put into words how much I dislike this, but I want to go home. For that reason, I like this one a lot. We come to what I think is probably the punkest song on the album, sonically, in the end.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting you say that. I think it's... I feel like this is their rancid song.
It feels like something off Let's Go, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that works. It's really catchy, and it's got that lovely, so I hope you won't be there in the end when you come around. It's got another little bass breakdown bit. Yeah, got a lot of time for this. Apparently this is about Billy Joe Armstrong's dislike of the man his mum married.
Oh, okay.
Bit of stepdad bashing. That's also another thing. This is sort of navel-gazy and teenage in a way that is also a bit more accessible than, like, severe drug psychosis and clinical depression like Kurt Cobain had.
Yeah.
In Utero is not a relatable album.
No.
For as many people as... Oh, I've not really got much going for me. I'm 17 and I just wank a lot and smoke weed. It's like, mate, there's a thousand million people out there that can get on this and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then again, the slightly more emo-y thing of the broken home, people consider that to be like an emo hallmark.
Yeah, sure.
So we've got a little flavor of that in there, all contributing to the Dookie was the first emo album. Hashtag conspiracy.
Ground zero.
Here we are right here. But yeah, this is good. But it's this one suffers a little bit because I know that FOD is coming. And I love FOD.
Yeah, FOD is great.
Mm. And it starts off with the worst bit of production, which is that acoustic guitar sound.
Yeah, I mean, so like I was listening to this in the kitchen. I was doing something else and I listened to all the album up until this point, and all of the album had been super audible up until this point, and then this bit was difficult to hear, and so I made the mistake of turning it up only to a few minutes later regret that.
I think that this song has been responsible for a lot of broken top loader CD players. Yeah. Back in the long ago.
It's just my partner was asleep at the time, so then when
not for long
it properly kicked in,
yeah,
it was a problem.
yeah and you've not been well, have you?
No.
So yeah, I bet that was fun. I noticed you used the word partner instead of fiance. Has it gone backwards?
Oh, no. I don't like saying fiance.
I just thought because if you woke her up with that, then...
Right.
Right, we're not ready for this. We're going to back this one down a step.
Like, yeah, there's a lot of words that... You know, there's English words that we pronounce French in the English language, but I never feel right
fiance
saying
fiance is a French word.
You know, like rendezvous. Rendezvous back here. No, I can't. I don't know. Doesn't feel right.
I know what you mean. At least RSVP has the decency to be just initials.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even... That's, you know,
instead
of déjà vu, I'm going to start saying DJV.
DJV. Bit of the old DJV.
Wow, DJV.
Well, that's very Gen Z of you. Amazing. Love that for you. So I'm just doing Z face now. This is no good, is it? I'm the modern day Russell Kane. Just taken 20 years off my own age. So he's put them back now.
He has.
This is a song about somebody that Billy Joe Armstrong hates. Now we know one person. We know one person that he hates.
Oh, who does he hate?
He hates Tim Yohannan from Maximum Rock and Roll Radio and Fanzine.
Okay.
And 924 Gilman Street.
That's not I'm Telling Tim.
It's exactly I'm Telling Tim.
Ah.
So someone that Fat Mike, because we've got to make it no effects, baby. There's no way getting around it. Someone Fat Mike loved was, and he's mentioned in, I think he's mentioned in, maybe Gasoline as well. I Threw Gasoline on the Fire song, which says, I don't miss something. I do miss my old friend Tim. Because Tim Yohannan died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in 19... Oh, sorry. Yeah. Lymphatic cancer. I do apologize. He died in 1998. And Green Day had recorded a song called Platypus, I Hate You. On Nimrod, which was released the previous year, and it was just an incredibly invective, hateful, unrelenting thing. And apparently Billy Joe Armstrong tweeted in 2011, "Platypus was written for Tim Yohannan, and I pray to God I misspelled his name. Rest in shit, you fucking cunt." Yeah, I know.
That's so extreme. To it's say lot, that about a dead guy.
Yeah, a guy who'd been dead for 11, 12 years.
Wow.
12, 13 years, yeah. So there's a possibility that FOD was about Tim Yohannan, because as soon as they signed to Warner, they got banned from Gilman and they got slagged a lot by Tim Yohannan, because he was like, Tim Yohannan was like a professional gatekeeper. I mean, yeah, talk about punk rock elite. It was his job to keep punk rock elite in his mind. So it's possible that this is about Tim Yohannan.
So, it's so interesting because, you know, like I don't consider them to be a particularly angry band, but, you know, people that aren't particularly angry still get furious about certain specific things. So, I mean, I'd love to know precisely because, I don't know, I feel like the words that Billy tweeted, they're very strong, and you don't say that without serious and repetitive issues with someone.
Yeah, he did delete it quite quickly afterwards, according to Wikipedia. I took that information from the Tim Yohannan Wikipedia page. About a third of it is dedicated to that story.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I'm speculating, but given the timing of it, given that they signed the deal for this album and the subsequent four albums that came out afterwards in 93, and then in like early 93, and they recorded this album 6 months later and put it out a few months after that, it's very possible that the news that Green Day had signed to Reprise, a Warner subsidiary, meant that they were immediately kicked out of, you know, Gilman Street was no longer sacred ground to them, to quote Journey to the End of East Bay. And it could be that. It's very possible. Like the lines I'm taking prior to telling you to fuck off and die. This has got the heaviest guitar on it. When it kicks in, it's like metal tone, you know, like, but strummed punk. It's great. It's so good. And yeah, and when it kicks in with just that kick snare, it's, yeah, really, really good. Only slightly marred by the stupid song at the end. But it was the 90s, so we got to
Have in my notes, I don't get this all by myself. I just didn't get it. But I suppose what doesn't help is on Spotify, they separate it out as a different track.
Yeah.
And I think if I knew, oh, this is just a bonus track on the end.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I wouldn't pay much attention to it.
Yeah, it's played and sung by Trey Cool, and it's shit. It's sort of, I don't know if he heard the rest of the album. Do you know what I mean? Or whether they just, I don't know, because it's like, I mean, they clearly think they're having a laugh because someone's like joining in with the vocals in the background and they're like finding it funny. And it's just a song about having a wank.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's, as much as I'm like, oh, this song is silly and doesn't mean anything. You know, NOFX the same year did put My Heart Is Yearning
they
on
did.
An album. So.
But they didn't do it on such an earnest album.
Yeah, fair.
They also have a song on that album about a man who chooses to wear sandals.
Yeah.
So that's not as, I don't know, I don't find that as incongruent, but
fair.
You know, it's it lasts for very little time, and also you can just turn the album off by the time you get to the end of FOD. You know, it's quite easy. So, yeah, when I say this is a non-skipper, maybe I don't really mean that, or maybe I'm not classing that as it's a non-skipper. But I will only listen to 2/3 of one of the tracks.
Fair enough.
But that's not skipping; that's stopping. So, who knows? So, any final thoughts on Dookie?
It's really great. I'm glad that I've properly given it a proper couple listens all the way through, because I think it's a really well balanced album. Mm. It's not an album that's got you know, the four singles on it, and then you skip through the rest of the tracks. It's yeah. a pretty great album start to finish.
Yeah, it's strange. And I don't know if, because sometimes I feel like, because there's four of these songs are singles that you'd see on like MTV2, probably just mm-hmm. MTV for a while as well, or like Kerrang or any of the TV music stations, VH1 probably, you know.
Yeah.
VH1 definitely have them on. It feels like some of the album tracks maybe have a little less personality, but I think taken as a whole, this album is a wild success, and I can absolutely see why it was adopted as the rock, the punk rock album of choice.
Yeah.
For so many. And obviously they had, you know, would other albums have sold as many if they'd had Warner Brothers backing them compared to the independent labels? Most of the records we talk about in Peer Pressure.
Yeah.
But then, and we haven't done it yet, and we won't be doing it for a little while, but Stranger Than Fiction was released on Atlantic. Yeah. That was a major label release.
I do think all of this moaning about major labels and not, I think it is all a bit silly, because I think there's, so, you know, I think bands can sell out, but I don't think that every band that signs to a major label is selling out. I think that there are ways of doing it reasonably.
Yeah. I mean, I've mentioned this before, but I saw a conversation about Fat Mike Gets Strung Out.
Yes.
Which is Fat Mike and Baz arranging NoFX songs for a string quintet, which mm-hmm. was performed live, and then it was released on vinyl, obviously, because Mike's obsessed. Someone on Reddit said, what are everyone's feelings on Fat Mike Gets Strung Out? And some people are like, oh, I liked it. Oh, I didn't like it. Or whatever. You know, a normal conversation.
Yeah.
And someone said, seemed like a failed attempt to sell out to me. And I was like, what do you, what? Oh, yeah.
Well, his strings album.
String quintet covers of NoFX songs.
Well, the kids love string quintets, I mean, Eddie. All of the kids are playing violins on My Street Corner.
And he put it out in time for Mother's Day as well. He knew what he was doing. It's like, fucking hell, mate. What are you on about? It's like, what are you on about?
Here you are, Mum.
Yeah.
Fat Mike's new solo album.
Yeah. Oh, a string quintet version of Total Bummer. Just what I wanted. Thank you, son. It's just normal, isn't it? That's just a normal response. Like, think about what you're saying before you say sell out. Yeah. You know, I mean, because even the idea that that is any kind of a cash grab is absolutely insane.
Yeah, let me tell you now, that those albums did not sell out. Like, they are still available, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
There are original pressings still available.
I bet they're not, but that's only because they released 100 of them or something. You know, it sure. was like they did such a short run of them. Your local band that plays in the bar around the corner from you gets more pressings of their shit done than Mike did of Strung Out. You know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those things. I found that to be incredible, but it just highlighted the use of that insult, sell out. It's like, oh, NoFX are playing places on their tour where you have to pay a service fee to buy a ticket. Yeah, like everywhere in the world. Fucking Boom in Leeds charges it. That's how they make money.
If you're annoyed at booking fees in 2024, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, if you're annoyed at Ticketmaster booking fees, which are quite large, I understand. Yeah. But like a 10% booking fee is standard, and it basically means that the outlet selling the tickets can make some money from the platform they are providing. It's essential if you want to support live music. It keeps ticket platforms going, and most of them are very reasonable, decent companies.
Most of them,
not all.
No. We are not saying all of them, and there are some that are absolute shits.
But even then, like, Ticketmaster are only shits at their highest level. That Ticketmaster sell all sorts of reasonably priced tickets. The problem is when you want to go and see fucking Bruce Springsteen, Like, yeah, yeah. Actually, I think he's had words with Ticketmaster, and his tickets are a little bit more reasonable these days. But sure. Like, at a normal, you know, grassroots level, Ticketmaster are a perfectly reasonable outlet to deal with. But as soon as you get into like stadium transatlantic bullshit, then they start piling on the exploitation.
And Brexit has a lot to do with it as well in the
UK.
So that's not, obviously that only relates to the UK. We understand if you're not in the UK, we get that. But because mainly I look at the ticket prices of places in the UK. So that conversation comes up a lot. So, you know, that's that. But yeah, they didn't sell out. They made a great, great album. Still my favorite album by them.
Yes, same.
And I love Nimrod, and I love Insomniac. They never quite came back for me after Warning.
Fair.
I didn't dislike them. I've seen them at like Leeds Festival and stuff since 21st Century Breakdown and American Idiot and that kind of stuff. And whilst they're really good, I only ever truly get excited for those 90s songs. They were so good in the 90s. They were like, yeah, they didn't do anything. They couldn't do anything wrong musically in the 90s for me.
Yeah, fair.
Long live Green Day. They've earned their position as a legacy act, as far as I'm concerned. And they've kept on putting out records and stuff, even though they shouldn't have. They can do what they want. They can do what they want. Go and have a listen to Mosh Pet, a podcast by...
Oh, yes, by Cy Beckwith.
Cy Beckwith and Ellie Kumar. They are from the Northeast. Cy Beckwith is a massive Green Day fan and has spoken about Green Day at length. So if you want an utterly biased and unbalanced discussion of Green Day, go and speak to Cy, because he will only tell you how wonderful they are. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Dookie. We will bounce out and speak to you in the outro.
I was all by myself. I was doing a wank. I was wanking near someone, and then I did a wank.
Now, you thought we'd finished this bit. We hadn't. There was a secret track about doing a wank. Anyway, back to the outro.
Yeah, fair. It's what they would have wanted.
It's what they would have wanted. Dookie by Green Day. There we go. What a treat.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad we listened to this. Hello to new listeners if this is your first venture into Punk Rock Elite. We'll be doing a lot more albums from the year that punk broke, 1994.
Yes.
We'll be looking at influences of NoFX, as this is largely a NoFX podcast. Yep. And we've got plenty of interviews coming up.
We have. We've got interviews. We have got other album deep dives. And we are going to be talking at length about another album that came out in 1994, to which we are organizing a tribute. We are organizing Punk in Droblick 30th anniversary tribute to that, with lots and lots of bands from all over the world. And we mean all over the world.
Yeah.
We've been getting mixes back. We've been hearing the songs that are finally going to be...
It's taking shape.
It really is, and I am terrified. We still don't know how we're going to be distributing this.
Yes, yeah, so do let us know if you have any, you know, preference of physical copy, whether that be CD, vinyl, maybe you just prefer a digital download, let us know.
Yep. It'll definitely be digital. We'll definitely be able to do that, because we understand not everyone wants something shipping from the UK to wherever. Although we'd be willing to do that. That's fine. It is going to be, we do want the proceeds of this to go to a charity. We have yet to decide on that charity. We are talking, we are discussing, we are looking into that. And we're not making any money out of this. We are just, all the bands are donating these songs, and so we want to do that. We're willing to consider multiple charities if that's something that we can look at. But it's super exciting. We have got punk rock covers. We have got not punk rock covers. We have got a whole mess of genres and styles and approaches, and we're super pleased with what we've got coming in.
Yeah, we're really excited. We've been in the studio to make a couple contributions ourselves.
Yes.
And we're happy with the results. Like, it sounds pretty great.
We were really, really pleased. We thought oh, I hope we can do something that matches up to everyone else. And mm-hmm. what we've actually come away with, thank you to Ajit at Hellfire Studios, is something where we're thinking, well, at least we are not going to be the shittest contribution to this record, because there aren't going to be any shit contributions, I can guarantee you that. Mm-hmm. But also, it's like everyone else is coming out blisteringly well so far. So
really impressed with what I've heard so far.
Super, super happy. It's going to be a broad church of styles, and super, super excited about it. So yeah, let us know about that. We are going now because we're off to Manchester Punk Festival for the weekend.
We are, woo! Yeah.
So that's exciting. We'll come back with tall tales of what's going on, what went on, and all the excitement there. Also listen to Midlife Punk Podcast, who are organizing this tribute album with us. Without them, it would just be us.
True.
Say thank you. We fucking love you with gusto. Thank you very much for listening. I have been Eddie French.
And I've been Rad Redmond.
And we will continue to be against all better judgment. Until then, we'll see you next time on Punk Rock Elite. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Punk Rock Elite. It was a Pick Scraped and Fruitcake co-production by Eddie French and Red Redmond. If you're not following us on Instagram or subscribe to the podcast, please do. The main theme and production was done by Eddie French. Please contact us at punkrockelitepodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.